Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Citizenship Education Program and Black Women's Political Culture by Deanna M. Gillespie. Narrated by Lisa Renee Pitts. Publisher's Note. In this audio edition, you may hear references to visual elements present in the print and e-book formats of the book. Foreword. The Black civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s was the most important American social movement during the last century. Based on a long struggle for Black freedom in America, dating back to the 17th century, it mobilized thousands of Black activists and their white allies, gained the right to vote for Black men and women, and ended de jure racial segregation in public schools and colleges, parks, doctors' offices, stores, and many public and private places, among other advances. It also opened elective office to Black men, and it produced great Black leaders, among them Martin Luther King Jr., Bayard Rustin, James Farmer, Ralph Abernathy, Bob Moses, Andrew Young, and John Lewis. The Black civil rights activism moved along two fronts of legal challenges and direct action against racial discrimination. Such landmark U.S. Supreme Court decisions as Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, struck down the principle of separate but equal that had provided constitutional cover for Jim Crow laws and white power for generations. At the same time, well-publicized direct action campaigns, such as protest marches, boycotts, and sit-ins, provided constant pressure to end racial discrimination in transportation, education, and public services, spaces, and facilities of all kinds, and to get equal access to private businesses, such as lunch counters and restaurants, motels and hotels, and amusement parks and movie theaters. Such action mobilized tens of thousands of people to protest social wrongs and force change. It also led to the passage of such major congressional legislation as the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Much of that story of civil rights has focused on the leadership roles of men, but the dynamics and direction of civil rights activism owed much to the leadership and work of Black women. During the 1950s and 1960s, for example, they helped desegregate schools, organized and sustained boycotts and sit-ins, marched, arranged and attended rallies, gave speeches, and lobbied public officials. Examples abound. Clara Luper emerged as a leader in desegregating the University of Oklahoma starting in 1958 and gained prominence in that state as a sit-in organizer. Rosa Parks helped lead the Montgomery, Alabama branch of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, and won lasting fame for refusing to give up her seat on a Montgomery City bus to a white man in 1955, which inspired the Montgomery bus boycott. Ella Baker encouraged the creation of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and a more aggressive direct action approach to protesting. Fannie Lou Hamer became a leading civil rights orator who organized Mississippi's Freedom Summer and led voter registration efforts, and there were many others. In her cogent study, The Citizenship Education Program and Black Women's Political Culture, Deanna Gillespie brings to the fore the many Black women involved in citizenship education and voter mobilization across the South. In doing so, She demonstrates that the civil rights movement went well beyond the mass demonstrations, speeches, and legislation that garnered so much public attention in newspapers and on newscasts. In regard to citizenship education, it involved women as local organizers and leaders in an effort throughout the South to gain the right to vote for African Americans. Doing so, Gillespie argues, was subversive work in the Jim Crow South. As Gillespie emphasizes, the citizenship education program was important for both Black and women's rights, on the latter count because the formal enfranchisement of women in the 19th Amendment in 1920 did not enfranchise Black women in the South until Blacks organized to get it, and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 provided federal protection for it. Her close study of the citizenship education program and the many women engaged in it as teachers is an insightful reminder that it took more than rallies, marches, speeches, court rulings, and legislation to promote and gain Black rights. It took the persistent day-to-day labor of thousands of Black women teaching others how to read and write so as to be able to pass literacy tests and exercise political influence. By telling that story, Gillespie's book is a welcome addition to the Southern Descent series. Stanley Harold and Randall M. Miller, series editors. Introduction. The air was already heavy and warm. Morning breezes kept the room at a comfortable temperature, but handheld church fans at each seat hinted at the warmer afternoon ahead. As workshop participants finished a traditional Southern breakfast, a few conversed with friends from home while others made small talk with new acquaintances. Still others gazed out the windows at the Dorchester Academy's wide lawn. For some, the live oaks and Georgia pines seemed a world away from rural hometowns scattered across the South. They looked forward to the beach field trip, where they planned to collect seashells and gather sand in Coca-Cola bottles for friends and family back home. Promptly at 9 o'clock, Dorothy Cotton walked to the chalkboard at the front of the room and asked them to take their seats. She opened the session with a prayer and group singing. As the last notes faded, she asked, "What is a citizen?" They carefully considered the question. The first to respond said, "Someone who doesn't break the law." Others picked up on this idea, adding, "Following the Ten Commandments and if you treat your neighbor right." Cotton patiently encouraged responses and waited for the moment. It happened in every workshop. One of the students mentioned the Constitution. Cotton beamed and asked, "What is this Constitution?" and sparked intense dialogue. 100 years after passage of the 14th Amendment, the gathered adults were reminded, or learned for the first time, that all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. No state can breach or privilege this. Cotton emphasized the last phrase, "No state can breach or privilege this." For Southern African Americans, this information radically altered their relationship to the state. On this morning, they learned and accepted that there was something called the supreme law of the land and an amendment that says no state can breach this. As the discussion continued, participants started to get a new awareness of their own power. Between 1961 and 1970, similar discussions marked the opening of the Southern Christian Leadership Conferences, SCLC, Teacher Training Workshops for the Citizenship Education Program, CEP. From its origins on the South Carolina coast in 1957, the CEP spread to every southern state by 1969, gathering in churches, living rooms, beauty shops, and community centers. Citizenship school teachers, mostly black women, taught friends and neighbors to read and write. This was subversive work in the Jim Crow South because reading, writing, and calculating was empowering. Literate black men and women gathered their own information, figured fair compensation for a hard day's work, and registered formal complaints, and they walked up courthouse steps, faced white courthouse clerks, and took literacy tests for voter registration. In the segregated South, teaching literacy for political action could crack the foundation of white supremacy. Citizenship school teachers were well aware of this potential and nurtured the individual transformations that sowed seeds for collective action. CEP students practiced ABCs in lessons designed to spark discussion about the very meaning of citizenship, blending traditions of participatory democracy and a deeply rooted gendered political culture. CEP students and teachers enacted a citizenship that was more than an abstract status conferred by the state. First-class citizens acted in service to self, family, community, and nation. CEP classes became gathering spaces where local people discussed, organized, and demanded change. From these makeshift classrooms, they contributed to the groundswell for social justice. This book tells the citizenship school teacher's story. These women are not new to the civil rights narrative. In photographs of mass meetings, they are there, singing, praying, and giving hard-earned money to support the cause. When organizers recall direct action campaigns, these women are there, marching, cooking, brewing pot after pot of strong coffee, and opening their homes to field staff and volunteers. In news reports about violence that kept pace with nonviolent action, these women are there as well, mourning the dead, comforting the injured, and nursing their own wounds. There was a tie that binds, and for many Southern African American women, that tie was the Citizenship Education Program. Like the contrast dial on an old television, this book brings their work into sharp focus. This is not the first study to reveal CEP teachers at work. The program originated through a partnership between local leaders on the South Carolina coast and the Highlander Folk School. In 1961, the SCLC assumed administrative responsibility for the newly renamed Citizenship Education Program. As a result, the program has been incorporated into studies of these supporting institutions. Memoirs by civil rights organizers document CEP teachers' leadership and participation in local campaigns. Recent trends in civil rights historiography shed further light on the citizenship schools. Beginning in the 1990s, historians shifted the spotlight from charismatic male leaders to broaden perspective on the civil rights movement, directly challenging gendered characterizations of women as supporters and followers. Within this scholarship, Catherine Mellon Sharon's biography of CEP founder Septima Clark provides the most comprehensive assessment of citizenship school teachers' reach and impact. At the same time, local histories reframed a top-down narrative that privileged civil rights organizations and the federal government. These historians advanced not one mass movement, but a framework of civil rights movements where collective momentum from a web of local struggles generated the groundswell for political, social, and economic reform. These studies often captured CEP teachers' leadership and activism before the movement arrived and after a local campaign ended. The CEP's emphasis on literacy as a strategy for social change has drawn attention from education scholars. In this field, David Levine's work represents the most comprehensive study of the program's blend of literacy education and political empowerment. Across the South, local women integrated CEP teaching into ongoing community service, which helps explain why this region-wide mass mobilization remained largely hidden from view. Everyone and no one knew about CEP classes, which creates a problem when trying to piece the puzzle together because, as historian T.E. Morris wrote about Mississippi's Woman Power Unlimited, this is simply what Black women did, without fanfare or expecting praise. Much of this community work went undocumented. However, in the CEP, teachers submitted attendance reports to receive monthly stipends. These reports, along with teachers' correspondence and surveys, were transferred to the King Center and Emory University. Thus, the CEP offers a rare opportunity to render the invisible visible. Still, there are gaps. CEP reports document extensive activity in South Carolina, but local teachers' attendance records and correspondence are missing in archival collections. Attendance records, surveys, and program reports from late 1965 to early 1969 are scant compared to previous years. Existing records tell incomplete stories because teachers who wrote lengthy narratives were the exception. The majority recorded brief comments in limited space provided on CEP forms. Oral history interviewing filled in some gaps, and a few former teachers graciously shared their stories. I found details about others in secondary sources, oral history collections, and local newspapers. U.S. Census and vital records and newspaper articles shed further light. I located more details in organizational records as varied as the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission. The Citizenship Education Program and Black Women's Political Culture assembles these fragments to reveal an expansive story of Black women's grassroots activism, adding to scholarship that reframes a standard narrative of the civil rights movement. The CEP fits into a familiar Montgomery to Memphis time frame, but alters the perspective to highlight lesser-known people and places. In the same year as the U.S. Supreme Court's landmark decision in Brown v. Board of Education, the citizenship school idea was born in discussions between Johns Island community activist Esau Jenkins, Charleston school teacher Septima Clark, and Highlander Folk School director Miles Horton. A month after a citywide bus boycott ended in Montgomery, Charleston beautician Bernice Robinson opened the first citizenship school on Johns Island. As television cameras followed freedom riders into Alabama and Mississippi in the spring of 1961, the CEP relocated to the SCLC's Atlanta office. In 1962, with attention focused on Albany, Georgia, the program took root across the state in Savannah, eventually spreading to rural counties across the first congressional district. Later that year, local women organized CEP classes in the Mississippi Delta, just as SNCC organizers moved into the region. By the following year, CEP classes opened in Mississippi's southeastern corner. As college students attracted national attention during Freedom Summer, CEP teachers and students staffed multi-service community centers and registered voters for the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, MFDP. By the end of that summer, CEP veterans were among the MFDP delegates on the national stage at the Democratic National Convention. The following spring, Martin Luther King Jr. led marchers out of Selma. Cameras trained on King did not notice CEP teachers organizing in his wake. Into the late 1960s, local people adapted and applied CEP lessons in new battles for political empowerment and economic and social justice. Focusing on the CEP contributes to a broader understanding of where, when, why, and how the movement happened. Centering on the CEP also expands our understanding of who organized and who led. As Septima Clark explained, "The teachers we need in a citizenship school should be people who are respected by the members in the community, who can read well aloud, and who can write their names in cursive writing." These criteria cast a wide net and pointed to Black women as primary agents. When Southern state legislatures passed segregation laws in the late 19th century, teaching remained one of the few professions open to Black women. Within separate school systems designed to reinforce racial inferiority and second-class citizenship, Black teachers told and retold stories of resistance and achievement. The CEP drew on this role and these traditions. CEP teachers differed in age, experience, education, social class background, and occupation. However, teaching was familiar work, rooted in a gendered political culture nurtured over generations. Across the South, school teachers came out of retirement to organize CEP classes, while the program attracted teachers forced out of public schools in post-Brown purges. Beauticians mobilized community networks and opened classes in independently owned businesses. Association with the SCLC brought the program into Black churches and tapped into church women's networks. Recent high school graduates, inspired by young people sitting at lunch counters, organized CEP classes. Still, others had simply grown sick and tired of being sick and tired. The CEP welcomed this diverse group, mobilizing leaders and community networks in support of the broader movement. The flexible criteria for teachers, coupled with a structured workbook, supporting materials, and schedule, provided a blueprint that was transferred from one community to the next. The CEP always operated on two levels, institutional and local. The Citizenship Education Program and Black women's political culture intertwines these narratives. Program administrators, first at Highlander and later at the SCLC, set policies, designed and led training workshops, recruited local teachers, crafted materials, and managed finances. CEP expansion within a rapidly changing landscape required ongoing revision and refinement, a process also taking place at the local level as CEP teachers and their students adapted and interpreted program lessons. Using a case study approach, the Citizenship Education Program and Black Women's Political Culture examines groundwork in areas with concentrated CEP activity, as well as the dynamic interactions between local people and organizations. Time and place mattered because communities and states crafted the narratives of slavery, Reconstruction, redemption, and Jim Crow segregation in different ways. CEP classes fit into local histories that teachers had helped and were helping to shape. In addition, The movement arrived at different times and in different ways so that in some places, CEP classes provided the impetus for local action, while in others, CEP teachers sustained and intensified momentum from local campaigns. Their work centered on common goals, improving literacy, increasing Black voter registration, and mobilizing friends and neighbors. How they went about this work depended on local context. The program name serves as analytical threads woven throughout the book. The first thread is citizenship. In CEP classes, teachers and students claimed and enacted first-class citizenship, broadly defined. Local classes prepared Southern Black people to confront political systems hardened through decades of rigid enforcement. Since the late 19th century, the federal government consistently deferred suffrage questions to states, lending tacit support for complex voter registration laws. In Southern states, poll taxes, literacy tests, grandfather clauses, and frequent registration renewal functioned as designed. Punctuated with extra-legal violence and harassment, laws effectively purged Black voters and blocked registration into the 20th century. African Americans won an important victory in 1944 with the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Smith v. Allwright to end all white state primaries. In the late 1950s, the CEP tapped into a groundswell, pushing to remove remaining obstacles to Black voter registration. In classes, teachers reinforced a Reconstruction-era understanding of suffrage as a collective, not an individual possession. First-class citizenship, like freedom in the post-Civil War South, would accrue to each, individually, only when it was acquired by all of them collectively. Registration and casting a ballot were important markers of first-class citizenship, but CEP lessons extended beyond voter registration. By the end of a 3-month course, students gained an all-around education in community development. According to program lessons, first-class citizens practiced nonviolence, paid taxes, and were safe drivers. They had first-rate handwriting, were polite, and demonstrated good manners. CEP teachers were expected to teach and model these behaviors. The CEP spread across the South, in part because the program echoed racial uplift ideas of the early 20th century. Couched in an ideology of bourgeois respectability, the CEP posited that African Americans became first-class citizens through education, behavior, and presentation. Each individual reflected on the entire community, and it took all to counter racist stereotypes that underpinned segregation. The CEP mobilized several thousand people who agreed with the underlying argument. Direct action campaigns are a significant part of civil rights history, and rightfully so. The CEP was a different strategy that mobilized a different group of people. Although some teachers and students participated in sit-ins, picket lines, and marches, situating CEP classes in the center of the narrative shifts our view into private spaces where seemingly more moderate leaders tapped into older ideology to mobilize communities. Approached another way, this seemingly moderate approach proposed a radical redefinition of citizenship. Citizenship was not simply a performance for white approval. Citizenship was active and collective, and CEP lessons empowered African Americans to claim all that had been long denied and to remove markers of inferiority imposed through racial segregation. Collective action fundamentally shifted the power that maintained white supremacy. When local people mastered first-rate handwriting, they replaced...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?